accession number 20478, reel 4.
Jack French, reel 4. What happened when you got to the fort?
There were searchlights scanning the waters around the fort. As a consequence, it was decided by Lieutenant Commander Kearns to get in as close to the opposite shore at the mouth of the river as was possibly acceptable. We managed to pass through the forts without them recognising us, despite the fact that the film says we were fired upon. Now, my own personal opinion on this, whether they seen us with the searchlights or not, is that had they seen us, I don't think they would have fired upon us. Because like the Montevideo do with the Graff's Bay, his scuttling the ship was decided on the fact that he wasn't aware of what ships lay outside the harbour. And I'm convinced that at the forts, they weren't aware of what ships were waiting outside the harbour. Namely, had it been a cruiser carrying 6-inch guns, they would have been able to hit them far easier than they'd be able to hit the ship. That is only my personal opinion. Anyway, we did get through the Wusong forts okay.
So you think they might have been frightened of retaliation?
I think so. Because there were other ships being registered towards the Yangtze, but they weren't aware of what was already there. But as I say, that is my personal opinion, maybe wrong. The next thing was that having gone past the Wusong forts, the next thing was that the Concorde came steaming up towards us from the south. Once again, signals flying from one to another. One I can remember is fancy meeting you from us. And a typical example of how contained you can get within yourself, that after meeting the Concorde and following in her wake, that I said to the two lads, I'm just going outside to get a breath of fresh air. And I no sooner opened the watertight door onto the upper deck than I saw a thin sliver of land. And what went through me then right away was, oh, we're not out yet. I better get back inside. But it wasn't until on recollection that you think to yourself, well, that land was 20 to 30 mile away, but your inside is built up to such a degree that that is what went through my mind. We haven't made it yet. We were then escorted by the Concorde down to anchorage called the Saddle Islands, where ships have been known to anchor if they want a break before going away on another job. And we just about made that with the last slipper of oil. We then stayed at the Saddles until the Jamaica come up to join us, and she brought our mail. Reliefs for me. how we got the oil from, whether we got it from the Jamaica or not, I don't know, because I was working inside. But we got restocked with oil. Stopped there for most of the day so that people could sleep and have a good rest before proceeding on to Hong Kong. From that time onwards, I didn't have to keep a watch.
Was that a relief to you?
It was. And I was able to settle down and get up to date with all my mail and things like that. It was a nice gesture by the people. They said, no, you've done your work. Away you go. So from then until we hit Hong Kong, I had a life of luxury.
Did you get much of a reception in Hong Kong?
Yes, it was incredible, really, even though the weather wasn't very generous. It was quite a heavy sort of a day with drizzle most of the day, but the amount of people that were on the jetties and the shorelines to greet us, as well as firecrackers, ships, hooters. There was even a fireboat, I think, that it was included in the celebrations. It was incredible. My next job then, of course, was gathering in the money for telegrams, which was quite a bit of a boon, really. One thing that did annoy us was that during the first part of the action, when the wounded were in the far aftermath, say, that if they required a drink of squash or anything like that, people, the canteen manager who was assisting on the wounded as well, left the naffy open so that people could get them a drink of squash and also cigarettes if they required a cigarette. This occurred for about 24, maybe 48 hours before he started billing everybody for whatever they wanted. As a consequence of this 24, 48 hours, there was a loss of funds to the Navy. And they were persistent to the nth degree that every penny had to be paid. And this, I think, stuck in our craw. The fact that they could have lost the whole lot of the goods had we scuttled the ship. And it went on and on until such time as it was decided by the base in Hong Kong that the Navy would recoup their loss from the sports club, the sports funds. As I say, to me, that rankled. After that, we had receptions in Hong Kong, over the top, really. And it was arranged that we would be farmed out to people who were willing to let us have a week's leave with them. This, of course, would be the community of Hong Kong that arranged this between them, I suppose. And I can remember that myself and the two electricians were victualled in with an American businessman who went away each day and left us in sole control of his house. And of course, he had all the latest gizmo, which was a record player and a massive collection of records, and we are the freedom of the ice. I can also remember that next door to them, to him, was a Swedish family, and at 11 o'clock we were always called in for their usual drink of Pimm's. And I suppose that is about it.
What about reception in London, in England?
Oh, well, no matter where we went, actually, Penang, Singapore, Ceylon, Malta, Gibraltar, London, receptions galore. They were only too thrilled to look after us.
You said that when the breakout came, that you only expected to last for a short time.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because the guns that were trained on us, that we expected to be blown out the water, really. I mean, they were already trained onto the position itself, and just like the deviation to the right would have followed us up.
And when you were stuck for all those weeks in the Yangtze, did you ever think that you'd be there forever?
Well, after about the fourth rejection of at the meetings, the biggest thing that always came up was who fired first, and that was always the first meeting of any series of meetings, to the point whereby, as I said, oh, we'll be going out next week, the next meeting would be right back to the original, you fired first. No, we didn't. So I think we got acclimatized to the fact that we could be there forever until such time as we had no oil, we had no food. So I suppose that was why the decision was eventually made to make the breakout.
Did any of the crew say, well, let's sign it, even if it's a lie?
Oh, no, no. No, the whole crew, even though it was a very junior crew, a few older men, you know, in the senior positions, but the biggest majority of the crew, I'd say, was from 17 to about 23, 24. Because we had already had a fresh input of crew before we sailed up to Shanghai, and they were literally straight out of training, really. A lot of whom were boys under the age of 18.
But did any of them think that you should sign this?
Oh, no. We didn't have any say in it, but we wouldn't have agreed with it anyway, I don't think, myself. I mean, there was two people that was in hospital, and they were asked to sign, as far as I can gather, to the fact that we fired first, but they didn't, and they were very young as well.
What did you think of the people who were holding you captive?
Well, I don't think in a situation like this you can really think anything. It's politics, isn't it? It's above and beyond our reach, really. Even to the ambassadorial side, I think it went higher than that.
What did people think of Commander Cairns?
Well, first off, of course, when he came aboard and started saying, oh, we've got to clean up and buff up the ship and all that, not very much, I don't think, because the ship was in hell of a state. And to try and clean that lot up in the predicament that they had been through, I suppose it probably did enter their head that, hello, well, here's the old slapstick, you know. But on the whole, everything was taken into account. You know, they probably had that thought when he first cleared lower deck. I didn't go down to that meeting. I was in the office, as I say. I was about the only one that wasn't there. That, you know, I can only go by what the press has led us to believe more than what actually happened. I mean, you've got to be there, really, to see the feelings. This is where the press fall over. They imagine things that doesn't occur. Yes. I mean, same with the film people. I mean, if you see the film, I went ashore in the whaler. But in truth of fact, I did not go ashore in the whaler. I actually swam ashore, came back in the whaler.
Did you have any after effects from the Yangtze incident?
Well, it's still with you. If people tend to burrow a bit deep, I must say now I'm feeling much better about it. In fact, until about 3 or 4 years ago, when I was asked to give a talk down in Wales to an RNA club, I was unable to really delve too much into it because the sights that I saw, especially in that after mess deck, would come back. And more so because one of the worst was a messmate who didn't make it. But it's carefully, actually, it was funny, really. I went down to the Naval
Association.
That they have every year or every other year when the fleet's open, Naval Days. And the PDSA was able to get hold of the medal for Simon the Cat, and I was asked if I'd attend, so that if there was any questions to be answered, I could give the answers to. And it was funny that whilst down there, that these members from the Carefully branch of RNA happened to speak to me. They must have gone back to their president and said, oh, we've met Jack French down there. What about arranging for him to come down one night and just give a talk on his experiences? And I went down, and there was one point where I almost, what can you say, tongue-tied. I couldn't carry on for a minute or so. But after that, I felt better, and since that, I've been able to talk more and more about the incident. But I think it's with you all your life, you know.
Any memories of the cat?
Not personally, because he wasn't allowed in the WT office.
Why not?
Hair, cat's hair, equipment. Doesn't mix, but he never required to come in there. He was in the captain's cabin and waltzing around the ship. The WT office was always closed anyway, the door, for security reasons. So he never wandered into the WT office. The only thing I will say about the cat is I think he died because he lost the company of sailors. He had been aboard the ship. He never once wandered over the gangway and was quite content to be aboard the ship. Then they take him out and put him into quarantine. They could quite easily have left him on the ship and let him gone out on the next commission, which the ship did. It done another commission out in Korea. But I'm firmly of the opinion that the ship died of heartbreak, shall we say, that he missed the company of the sailors.
So you think he pined away?
Definitely.
How many years had you signed on in the Navy for?
I came back from that, and I was extended service at the time. And my mother was severely ill, actually, whether our incident played on it, but she was severely ill. And it was our wish that our sister got married and gone to Liverpool to live, and it just left myself, my brother, and father, if anything happened to my mother. So she said to me, "Jack, carry on with the Navy." So that is what I'd done. She died the following year that I came home.
So when did you leave the Navy?
In 1966. And then went to work in GCHQ.
I think you said that you were later in a Suez crisis?
Yeah.
Is this 56?
This was on board the Gambia in 1954, when we were put as guardship at Port Said, when pilots were refusing to ply the canal, and the Navy provided navigating officers to lead the convoy through the canal. It was on the way back from a month at the canal that we were called to the Zante earthquake. And unfortunately, we did not have a great deal of supplies, but we were able to give them blankets, provide them with water, and loaves of bread.
Is this in Greece?
In Zante, one of the Greek islands. And we spent 48 hours also assisting with wounded, digging out people from the buildings, three of which were all that was left standing.
Which year was this?
That would be in 1954. But we were able to send reports to Malta so that the Bermuda could relieve us and also load up with requirements of what was required by the people in Zante. Another thing that happened aboard the Gambia, we met the Royal Yacht the first time that the King, the Queen and Prince Philip sailed in her. Then in August 1954, we withdrew the RM Commandos from the Canal Zone. That's when the troops moved out altogether from the Canal Zone. And we also carried Emperor Haile Selassie to UK for his official visit in October 1954. My next trip was on HMS Orwell in 1955, when we escorted HM Yacht Britannia on the Queen's Round Britain tour. And it was the first time that radio teletype was introduced into the Navy. I was also on HMS Albion in 1956 in November, when the invasion of Suez Canal ensued.
What do you remember about that?
That we were at action stations quite regularly. because we were carrying the first division planes. And we remained, being the junior ship out of the three carriers, at sea for 6 weeks. Travelling up and down whilst negotiations were carried out. Then in January 1957, the withdrawal of the troops from the Suez itself, and we came up to Invergordon for the fleet review. In 1958, I was on Loch Ruthven in the Persian Gulf for 18 months, duties of which consisted of gun running, slave trade, opium smuggling, things like that. In July 1961, I was recalled from leave at 6 o'clock in the evening to take charge of a special naval party, 9136, for the original Kuwait confrontation, but nothing came of it, fortunately. Apart from normal Mauritius, I was at that time actually on draft to go to the Far East on HMS Bulwark, but being rushed out there, somebody had to take my place, and I came back too late to join her. So I went to Mauritius and commissioned the first fully automatic message switch for all general service traffic. HMS Lion, in 1964 attended the Gambia Independence. That was in February 1965, the actual independence. And after that, I was sent to Portland for flag officer sea training, whereby you went out to sea each day and worked up ships that had just commissioned, telling them or advising them on what is expected in their general workings on board ship. And we worked with the Nigerian Navy there, the German Navy. There was another couple, but I can't remember what they were. But even foreign navies used to come over there because the training was so good for a ship commissioning that they'd send their small ships over for the 6 week training period. And then 1966, I finished with the Navy.